Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 268, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, with Pilar Jennings. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The student or the client really begins to internalize the teachings of the tradition through the relationship. So it's through an intimate encounter. It's through really getting to know the therapist in terms of that intimate relational experience, and through getting to know your Buddhist teacher through, you know, a deep sharing, that the fruits of the tradition come to be.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Pilar Jennings, speaking about the key role that relationship plays in both psychoanalysis and Buddhism. Pilar Jennings, PhD, is a writer and researcher who is focused on the clinical applications of Buddhist meditation practice. She received her PhD in psychiatry and religion from Union Theological Seminary, and has been working with patients and their families through the Harlem Family Institute since 2004. Dr. Jennings is also a researcher at the Columbia University Center for the Study of Science and Religion, as well as a facilitator of a Columbia University faculty seminar. Dr. Jennings is a long-term practitioner of Tibetan and Vipassana Buddhism. She is also trained as a Buddhist chaplain through the Zen Center for Contemplative Care. Dr. Jennings lives in New York City. Her 2010 book, Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, explores the interpersonal dynamics between Buddhist teachers and their Western students in comparison to the relationships between psychoanalysts and their patients. Dr. Jennings is a researcher at the Columbia University Center for the Study of Science and Religion, where she explores the impact of narcissism on environmental issues. She is also a facilitator of a Columbia University faculty seminar addressing topics related to slavery and memory. In her ongoing psychotherapeutic work with inner-city families, Dr. Jennings has sought to explore the impact of racism on children. With her unique approach to clinical work, she has integrated traditional psychological healing models and meditation. Through her training in chaplaincy and contemplative care at Beth Israel Hospital in New York, Dr. Jennings has brought the combination of her divergent interests and background to another population in need of sensitive psychological and spiritual care. As a contemplative care provider, she has made efforts to explore the psychological and spiritual needs of disenfranchised populations. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Pilar Jennings, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be here.
And I'm excited to have this opportunity to speak with you about your work, which, among other things, very carefully examines the commonalities and differences between psychoanalysis and Buddhism. But before we get into that, I was intrigued to learn that you got a really early exposure to Buddhist meditation. Tell us about that.
I did. I had the good fortune to be exposed to Buddhism when I was about 10 years old. I had a very spiritually curious mother. She was actually ethnically Jewish, sent to Catholic schools in Catholic Peru, where she grew up, but brought me to a variety of spiritual communities when I was a child, and then she and I enrolled in a Vipassana meditation course together. So it was, I would say, the first spiritual practice that felt very resonant. I had an immediate interest in what it meant to sit in silence, particularly since I was a child sitting with a group of adults who seemed to be taking it very seriously. So I figured there might be something meaningful going on.
That's interesting that at that early age that you really did take to it.
Yeah, I think it has something to do with my personality. I'm a relatively introverted person, though as a fairly shy child. So I think I was soothed by the experience of sitting in silence and being in a safe space where people seemed particularly gentle with themselves and with each other. So just on an intuitive level, I found the experience to be quite compelling.
That makes sense. So how did your journey along the Buddhist path continue from there? Maybe you can kind of just give us the overall arc.
Sure. Well, as I aged, I began reading more. So I read a fair amount of literature, some Buddhist scholars, Buddhologists. I was also reading a lot of Western psychology, and as I became a teenager and into my college years, it became clear to me that Buddhism seemed to be a very psychologically sophisticated tradition that really paid attention to our psychological experience, and that seemed to be part of the spiritual healing journey as it was laid out in Buddhist thought. So I began to glean a little bit more insight into the teachings, and little by little began to deepen my practice as well.
And at what point did you get exposed to psychoanalysis?
Also very, very early in life, not because I was in analysis, but because my mother is a psychoanalyst. So in addition to exploring meditation with her, I was aware that there were people who sought out therapists and analysts. I was aware of the concept of having a psyche, of having consciousness and having an unconscious. And I would say in my 20s, I became very curious about the relationship between these two worlds, what they had to offer each other, and what might not be addressed explicitly in each tradition that was found in the other.
And did you yourself go on to become a psychoanalyst?
I did, although it took some time. I mean, as the child of an analyst, I wasn't too keen on the idea of becoming one myself. I wanted my own path and my own sense of identity, and I resisted it mightily. I was a writer for many, many years and still consider myself primarily a writer. But as a graduate student, started exploring medical anthropology, and I was looking at illness narratives, which basically explores how people talk about pain. And in that work, I became increasingly curious about being a clinician and listening to experiences of suffering, as well as efforts to become joyful and happy and well.
So where did you do your training in psychoanalysis?
I went to a relatively little-known analytic institute called the Harlem Family Institute, which has, I think, an excellent and noble mission to bring psychoanalysis to the inner city and to just transcend the class barrier in psychoanalysis, generally speaking, which I think is still very much an issue and a struggle in many analytic communities. And one of my interests is in addressing race and class around spiritual and psychological issues.
Okay, well, we will come back to that topic towards the end of our interview, I think. But I'd like to now focus a bit on your book, Mixing Minds, which seems especially timely because meditation, especially mindfulness meditation, seems to be integrated into more and more therapeutic approaches. In fact, there's so much being written about mindfulness meditation that I've jokingly observed that we might be in the midst of a mindfulness bubble.
Anything's possible. I find that vision compelling. I'm not sure what it means, but I like it.
Well, I was thinking of the financial bubble, you know, how there's so much interest and excitement about the stock market until it crashes. And so I think we're maybe in a phase of similar level of excitement and interest in mindfulness meditation. But hey, these traditions have been around for a couple thousand years at least.
They've had some real staying power.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you point out that there are two major branches of Buddhism, the Theravadan and mm-hmm. the Mahayana, and both have been an important part of your own journey. Maybe you can give our listeners a brief overview of the history and practice of these two traditions.
Sure. So the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism is considered to be the original Buddhism that arose during the historical Buddha Shakyamuni's time. And Theravadan basically means school of the elders. And there was a split that took place quite some time later around the Vinaya, which were the original monastic rules. And the story goes that as the Buddha Shakyamuni lay dying, he suggested to his faithful assistant that, you know, with the changing times and the various causes and conditions, perhaps they could change some of those rules accordingly. And some of the monks agreed that this was a good idea, and others thought that was an impossible thing to figure out, which of these rules could be considered less foundational. And this is what facilitated the split. Basically, the teachings are the same in all of the various lineages within Buddhism, but there are different methods and slightly different understanding of how liberation happens, how we awaken to reality. In the Theravadan school, the idea is that before you can help anybody else, you really need to stay with your own mind and make efforts to awaken before embarking on the path of what's called the bodhisattva, or the person who forestalls their own entry into nirvana or liberation until all people are awakened. In the Theravadan school, you try and awaken first. In the Mahayana school, which includes Zen and Tibetan and Pure Land, the idea is that we actually wake up to reality, right? We become a Buddha, which just means awakened one, through the process of helping others, through the process of helping other beings become happy and free from suffering. So they're just slightly different approaches to this overarching goal of awakening to our Buddha nature or our innermost goodness and mind of clear seeing.
Okay. Now you point out that mindfulness meditation or vipassana, which comes out of the Theravadan tradition, tends mm-hmm. to have most resonance for those of us in this country. It's mm-hmm. it's somehow an easier, less demanding fit for us. And you point out that virtually all the teachers of Vipassana in the U.S. are, in fact, Westerners. Take us through that, if you will.
Sure. I think in any religious tradition, there's always the issue of culture and whether or not there's a cultural resonance between an individual practitioner and the tradition. And most American Buddhists, I think generally speaking, and again, these are generalizations because there are certainly many, many American Tibetan Buddhists and in every lineage, but generally speaking, I think many American Buddhists feel a certain comfort and compatibility with mindfulness because it seems like less of a religious practice and more of a philosophical system, more of a spiritual practice. And for people who feel uncomfortable with the idea of religion or being a religious person, it offers fewer roadblocks and potentially a quicker entry into the Buddhist practice of meditation.
And I had the impression that you started out as a practitioner of Vipassana, but then developed a hunger for something more demanding, more rigorous, and that led you into Mahayana.
true, although I think that the experience of mindfulness and vipassana can be profoundly rigorous. Anyone who's tried to just sit quietly with their own minds knows how difficult that can be.
Yes,
not easy just to be with ourselves, particularly in this culture of technology where we're really encouraged to be constantly, chronically overstimulated.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't wish to suggest that vipassana is not a rigorous process. It really is. For me, I felt the need for something that I experienced is more relational, more devotional, if you will. And Tibetan Buddhism is historically a devotional practice where there's a greater sense of externality, right? So there's no God in Buddhism, this is true. That said, in the Tibetan cosmology, you have the whole panoply of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and there's really a sense of relying deeply with devotion on this tremendous support system that transcends your own inner awakening. And so that way, it feels very different. It can, for me, it felt very relational.
Well, that's interesting. Speaking of the relational part, when I first encountered the subtitle of your book, The Power of Relationship and Psychoanalysis in Buddhism, mm-hmm. I was a bit nonplussed, I suppose because I had the image of Buddhist meditation as being very inner, focused on one's own mind and inner world. And so the idea of relationship didn't seem that central to me. But as I read your book, I realized that was probably because I'd been so influenced by the mindfulness school.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you're not alone in having that perception of Buddhism as being focused on individual experience. But ironically, the basic teachings of Buddhism are all about interdependence, right? They're all about the ways in which we co-create each other by nature of this deep structural interdependence. So there's actually a relational core in the teachings. It's just that those teachings get played out with very different methods based on the tradition you're in.
Of course, I know there's a considerable emphasis in Buddhism on compassion, and of course, and that's mm-hmm. very relationship-oriented by definition.
That's right. I mean, if somebody is really seeking to deepen a Buddhist practice, it's profoundly heart-opening and heart-centered, which again challenges a lot of the perceptions of Buddhism as being somewhat ascetic in nature, philosophical, intellectual. But really, at bottom, it's about awakening a much deeper, more authentic feeling for all beings, instead of that either disinterested neutrality that we tend to feel toward people we perceive as having nothing to do with us, or a lot of aversion toward the people we don't like, or a whole lot of desire and grasping for the people we want more of. And so in the Dharma, which basically means the Buddhist teachings, the idea is to recognize that all people are precious, right? All people are impermanent. They're all suffering. You know, that we have this profoundly shared experience and that others matter as much as we matter, and to ritually, daily reinforce that reality.
Earlier, you were talking about devotion, and you draw parallels between the relationship of spiritual teacher / guru to their student and the analyst to the analysand.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the similarities and the differences in those two relationships?
Sure. I mean, the whole reason why I wrote Mixing Minds is I was increasingly curious about these two primary healing relationships and how people experience Western psychotherapy or Asian Buddhism through relationship, either with a therapist or a Buddhist teacher. And in both of those healing couples, the student or the client really begins to internalize the teachings of the tradition through the relationship. So it's through an intimate encounter. It's through really getting to know the therapist in terms of that intimate relational experience, and through getting to know your Buddhist teacher through, you know, a deep sharing, that the fruits of the tradition come to be, are offered. I would say that the relationships are similar insofar as both a Buddhist teacher and a therapist would seek to be very respectful of the person they're working with, deeply curious about what their student or their client is sharing, and also ideally, hopefully, seek to create an experience of wellness, you know, of working through pain and suffering and coming to a place of wellness. Where they're different is in their understanding of what's possible, right, what wellness means, and how they go about that. So in therapy, generally speaking, a therapist would make efforts to be very curious about the personal nuances of a patient. So to learn many details about the patient's particular care providers, their family, their social location, really to leave no stone unturned. Whereas in a religious relationship with a Buddhist teacher, it tends to be a little bit more universal in focus. So the ways in which that Buddhist student is suffering universal difficulties that we all get ensnared in by nature of this shared mind. So it really zooms out to look at the human experience, whereas a therapist tends to zoom in and really look at the particularities of the human experience.
Okay, good. That's very helpful. And again, on the line of thought of devotion, at some level, I quotes, get the potential value of surrender to a spiritual teacher. But personally, I'm deeply leery of the pitfalls of guru worship in terms of Buddhism and the dangers of dependency in the psychoanalytic relationship. So I guess I'm very Western in this attitude. What can you share with us of your own attitude and experience along this dimension?
Well, Dave, you are not alone in having those concerns. They're widespread, and particularly in Western culture. And I think that's a product of many factors, not the least of which are the post-Enlightenment era values of the discrete individual being the locus for change, being the agent for all action. And so I think, generally speaking, we have this legacy of distrust and discomfort with dependency, right? Because we're so enculturated to be fiercely, vigilantly independent,
mm-hmm.
right? To try and figure things out on our own, to be skillful, to take care of business. And many people feel either consciously or unconsciously shamed by nature of needing others, particularly when we really feel like we cannot manage our problems alone. That tends to bring a great deal of shame. So I think that's a foundational current, you know, that informs the discomfort. But then, of course, you do have all the stories of power abuse and religious leaders causing a great deal of harm by nature of all the power they wield. So it's perfectly appropriate, I think, to be wary of potential religious mentors and therapists and carefully discern whether or not the mentors and therapist the person seeks out are trustworthy.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because you made reference to Buddhist tales of enlightenment by exasperation, in which a roguish teacher confounds the student's intellect by being very unpredictable. And given that tradition, do you have any guidelines as to how the Western spiritual teacher might distinguish between this kind of a teacher and a spiritual charlatan?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there are a few things to look out for. In fact, last night I was discussing with my students in a psychology and religion course Anthony Storr's wonderful book called Feet of Clay, which he analyzes what a guru is, through the lens of a variety of historical figures. And basically, and again, these are generalizations, but I think they're helpful. True religious mentors, people of faith who have a good, noble intention to simply support other people in moving through their experience of suffering, right, of feeling cared for, of learning from their experiences of suffering, they don't demand exclusive devotion. They're simply not interested in it. So if their disciple or their student tells them that they're curious about other faith traditions or they're even curious about other Buddhist teachers, a true teacher will be able to tolerate that. Right? They won't demand a kind of exclusive attachment. Nor will they have any real difficulty with criticism. So, you know, if a Buddhist student is feeling like they've had an uncomfortable exchange with a teacher, or they feel the teacher was rude, or, you know, they got distracted with their cell phone, whatever it is, you know, Buddhist teachers are people too, A good teacher will be able to really handle hearing that a student was not happy with an encounter. And they'll make efforts to reflect on those exchanges. So kind of like a good parent, there's wiggle room for humanness, there's wiggle room for real communication, and usually there's opportunity for some kind of direct communication around conflict.
I think we struggle with those issues both in on the Buddhist path and in psychoanalysis, right? And in that relationship, you know, geez, my therapist is human. How much humanity can I handle?
The question we have in all of our relationships, right?
Well, that's true.
We just don't want too much humanity in our relationship.
Right.
And for very good reason. But in terms of how much a therapist should expose of their humanness, that has something to do with match, right? I mean, some patients will really want a therapist to reveal a little bit more about the therapist's own personal experience, and others will not want that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every patient, every client has the right to seek out the kind of healing relationship that's going to work for them. And if a patient is beginning a therapeutic treatment and they feel uncomfortable with the level of sharing that's happening from the therapist, you know, they get to address that and potentially find a therapist who has clearer boundaries.
You know, as I read on in your book, I think I discovered that your title, Mixing Minds, was a kind of double entendre. On the one hand, it seems to refer to your comparison of Buddhism and psychoanalysis, but it also refers to a mixing of minds between analyst and analysand and spiritual seeker and spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell us about this mixing of minds, if you will.
Sure. In Buddhism, and particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a concept of the teacher's mind, their awakened mind, mixing with the mind of the student. And in that process, the student's mind comes to awakening. So it's a kind of deep intimacy in which the student discovers what they're capable of through connection with the teacher. And something similar happens in a relationship between a patient and a therapist. And I think in all close interpersonal relationships where we actually discover lost parts of ourselves through others. And often that has something to do with projection. So the ways in which we project parts of ourselves onto others. And there's also a term that Melanie Klein, who was a great object relations theorist, posited called projective identification, where we project onto other people the parts of ourselves that we are getting rid of, we're not comfortable with, and then we locate it in another person. And then we maneuver that person as if that part were their dominant attribute. And it sounds kind of mystical and like the stuff of science fiction, but it actually happens all the time. And when we're evacuating unwanted parts that are very negative, so our rage, our lust, our homicidal tendencies, etc., it can be very dangerous to project that onto another person and then perceive them as being rageful. But when a teacher is projectively identifying a tremendous capacity for compassion, right, for sensitivity, for insight onto their student, that can actually be profoundly enlivening. And I think something happens in the therapeutic relationship where the therapist or the analyst is locating, you know, their own curiosity, their capacity for wellness, their belief in wellness in the patient. And that starts to mix in with the patient's sense of who they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier you referred to Buddhism as a religion, and in fact, you have a chapter on Buddhism as a religion. And I think what I've been most drawn to in Buddhism is the secular view of it as more of a philosophy and a discipline than a religion. So your chapter title poses two great questions. Is Buddhism a religion, and is psychoanalysis a science?
Mm-hmm.
So what are your answers to those two koans?
Yes, indeed. Big, lofty questions. Well, I've raised the question about religion in part because of the relational issue that we were talking about before and the rather pervasive discomfort with dependency in this culture. And I think it is that discomfort that has a lot to do with why so many American Buddhists prefer to understand Buddhism as a philosophy or a spiritual practice. The tricky thing about that, and I think there's so many really excellent secular Buddhist teachers. They do a wonderful job of helping people really enter into Buddhism without all the trappings of institutionalized religion. The thing is, I mean, the common denominator in all the great religions is that wish to somehow transcend the self, right, and transcend our steadfast interest in ourselves and somehow get curious about a larger reality. You know, whether that's other people or the divine, it almost doesn't matter. It really has to do with our capacity to recognize that we are a very, very tiny, though very significant part of a world, right? And to somehow learn to contextualize ourselves in that world. That's the meaning making that happens in all the great religions. And I think to lift Buddhism out of its original religious context and posit it as a secular endeavor is potentially to bypass that endeavor, you know, of really, really wrestling with our ego, you know, the way we so wish to be front and center, you know, to be the main player in this world. But when we get fixated on that notion of being the main player, we tend to lose sight of the ways in which so many people around us are suffering, right? So many people around us need support that we could offer. But if we're too fixated on ourselves, we're not that likely to be curious about how we might offer that support.
Okay, I think you've really provided a basis for understanding how Buddhism, which in general doesn't rely on a concept of God, can mm-hmm. still be a religion. Because I sort of thought, well, you have to have God to have a religion, but you've really kind of shifted it a little bit.
I mean, generally speaking, all world religions have these so-called sacred reference or sacred symbols and beliefs that a community collectively invests meaning in. And in Buddhism, that meaning is found in Buddha or the Buddhas, so all awakened beings, the Dharma or the teachings of the Buddha, and Sangha, which means spiritual community. So it really does fit the criterion of being a religion. It's just that it's become quite a malleable religion, particularly in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe you can briefly touch on that other koan that you posed. Yeah. Is psychoanalysis a science?
Yeah. And I raise that question because, of course, so many therapists know that what happens in the therapist's office can feel quite sacred. Mm. It doesn't always just feel clinical. Sometimes there's a tremendous feeling of mystery. Sometimes there are tremendous feelings of reverence. I'm sure there are many, many therapists and analysts who have had experiences of something else moving into the clinical space that transcended their own theoretical insight or transcended the insight of their patient and had a spiritual valence. And so part of what I wanted to do in that chapter is just have a look at the aspect of clinical work that is not specific to our discursive minds, right? That isn't solely born out of our capacity to conceptualize the psyche. And I'm sure, you know, if you took a poll, the vast majority of practicing clinicians would probably suggest they have had such experiences where whatever it was that was facilitating healing had something to do with their insight and their training and the relationship between the patient and the therapist, and had something to do with something else that's less tangible.
I have to share that I often have that set of feelings about these interviews that I do.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, because I know that in some way I'm feeding a need and a hunger for people out there, and so I have a sense of mission about that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose this feeds into actually my next question, which is some people treat psychotherapy as a sort of religion, and mm-hmm. others pursue Buddhist practice as a substitute for psychotherapy. So
yeah.
What sort of healing can one expect from each, and what are the limitations of each?
Thank you. It's an excellent question, and it's a question I'm very sensitive to, in part because I live and practice in New York City, a place where psychotherapists are relatively common.
Right.
And, you know, many, many, many people living here and urbanites throughout the country seek therapists for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is to address their spiritual needs and condition. So often I think there's an expectation that a therapist can address the full spectrum of human needs. And I'm not convinced that that's the case. You know, while I was just suggesting that there is indeed a sacred element to clinical work, therapy is not a religion. right? It does have a particular methodology and a particular objective. So I'd love to see a little bit more humble respect for the limitations of each system, so that therapists might encourage or at least make known to their patients that, you know, if they're needing more support beyond the clinical space, there are spiritual communities, you know, there are ways in which they can be fed beyond, you know, the hour or two or three they're with a therapist.
Earlier, you mentioned your involvement in work with the disadvantaged in the inner city. How do your Buddhist and psychoanalytic orientations inform your work there? You know, as you pointed out, though, we tend to think of both of those realms as pretty separate from the issues that people in the inner city are struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, one issue that's particularly meaningful is the way in which we cultivate identity based on our particular modes of suffering. And I think, I mean, this is something everybody, particularly in Western cultures, will struggle with, is how our identity gets ossified. You know, particularly if there's trauma, there's a sense of being victimized or a survivor. And Buddhism can be very helpful in exploring the ways in which we get attached to identity because of the way we suffer, right? So often that linkage is unconscious for us. So if we're suffering due to injustice, right, that can reify a sense of being victimized and being in an unjust world that's fixed that way. And part of what I've been doing somewhat gently and with humble curiosity is just to, you know, help people that I work with contextualize their suffering and recognize that if they're suffering an injustice, and that there are many horrendous injustices in this world that, you know, many innocent people are subject to, this is an inroad to the human condition and the human family. You know, it's a way to potentially reinforce a sense of sensitivity for other people who are suffering in a similar way, rather than to feel separate from, shut out by, right, disconnected from. And it's also a way, potentially from a Buddhist perspective, to imagine that the suffering we're going through now might change, right? So one of the main teachings in Buddhism is impermanence, that because of the changing causes and conditions, nothing stays the same, including ourselves, right? Our identities are really very fluid, very dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think for people who are suffering and suffering injustice that seems really structuralized and entrenched, that can be a helpful approach so that hopelessness doesn't seep in and really kind of get into the bones.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're a bit of a political activist as well in your own, what, introverted way?
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I do care very much about suffering that's not so easily seen. And that would certainly be, you know, our inner lives and certainly the inner lives of disenfranchised populations. So in that way, I do bring an activist spirit to clinical work.
Yeah, so something that might be relevant. I just saw a wonderful film that I got on Netflix called Dharma Brothers about,
yeah.
Maybe you've seen it. It's about a series of 10-day Vipassana retreats in an Alabama prison. And this was based on a similar experiment in a prison in India. And there was also a wonderful film about that one, also available on Netflix, called Doing Time, Doing Vipassana.
Yes. These are wonderful movies. And in fact, I've seen Dharma Brothers several times and just watched it with my students recently.
Oh.
Because I found it to be so powerful. One of the things I loved about that film is it was the psychologist in the prison who realized that something else was needed to help the men heal psychologically.
Right.
It wasn't going to happen from any kind of traditional therapeutic treatment. And indeed, when you watch the film, you see that through this intensive spiritual experience, many of the men were resuscitating very, very intense emotional experiences around a variety of complicated traumas. And there was real healing taking place.
Yes, I was really impressed by that as well. Now, yeah. In your bio, you're described not only as a writer, but also a researcher. What sort of research are you involved in?
Well, it's been somewhat intermittent. I've been involved in the Center for Study of Science and Religion at Columbia University, which is founded and directed by a very fascinating biologist and person of faith, Bob Pollack. And I had the good fortune to meet Bob many years ago when I was a doctoral student, and he was teaching a very complicated course called DNA Evolution in the Soul, which I took and then tutored for him and have been involved in a few projects with him. He's very interested in environmental issues and sustainability, and at one point I was doing some research on the impact of narcissism on our struggles to recognize the environmental crisis. So that's yet another piece of my work.
Mm-hmm. Now, you refer to him as a person of faith, and that's a term that I would associate with Christianity. How does a person of faith apply? I'm assuming that he's also Buddhist. If so, how does that term person of faith apply in that context?
Bob is actually Jewish, but I think it's a good question for Buddhists. What do we understand to be faith?
Yeah, faith in what?
Right. I think if pressed, most Buddhists, even agnostic Buddhists, would tell you that, and you might have to hypnotize them to tell you this, but I think they genuinely believe that they have faith in our capacity to awaken and to enter into reality. And that's not something most people live out, right, at least on a daily, steadfast basis. Mm-hmm. But the reason why they stick with it year after year and retreat after retreat, right, day after day, sitting on the cushion, is because they have faith that they are actually capable of somehow working through the normal ways their minds operate to hold a larger sense of what reality entails. So I think without that faith, people wouldn't stick with it.
You know, that's probably a great place for us to wrap it up. So Dr. Pilar Jennings, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Dave, for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Pilar Jennings. Her book, Mixing Minds, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, is very nuanced. In this interview, I was only able to scratch the surface. Her book goes much more deeply in both into her own story and the complexities of relationship issues underlying both Buddhism and depth approaches to therapy. She's very careful and thoughtful in her approach, and she references the work of other important authors in these two fields, Buddhist meditation and psychoanalysis. I think serious students of Buddhist meditation and therapists in general, not just psychoanalysts, will want to have this volume on their bookshelf. You may also wish to visit her website at www.pilarjennings.com. And Pilar is spelled P-I-L-A-R, and Jennings is J-E-N-N-I-N-G-S.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring my spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. And Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
You're probably surprised to be getting this episode so soon. After all, I put one out just last Friday. And here I am just a week later putting out another. And the reason for that is I've been working ahead, and I discovered that I'm working so far ahead that some of my guests would have to wait more than 2 months before their show would come up in the rotation. And so I'm feeling like, well, that's not really fair to them. And so for a while here, I might be putting up weekly shows. Some time back, I decided I wasn't going to do that because I didn't want to overwhelm you with too much content. So hopefully you're not being overwhelmed and you're finding this a treat to get so much Shrink Wrap Radio so quickly. And also, I'm just now remembering that I didn't want to overwhelm myself, that because I was already doing 2 shows a month on Wise Counsel, and then doing weekly shows on Shrink Wrap Radio was just putting me in danger of burnout. So that's why I went back to a sort of once a week kind of format. But it'll be a bit more for a little while here, and hopefully no burnout. I recently received an email from one of our past guests, Jane Teresa Anderson, who I interviewed about DreamSight back in episode number 226. And you'll recall that she's a very skilled dream worker. She has shows in which she analyzes people's dreams right on the show. She analyzed one of my dreams, as you'll recall. And she's looking for guests. She's looking for guests who have a dream that they're puzzled by, and they're willing to come on the show and talk about their dream and talk about what's going on in their life. And she's also looking for authors, maybe, of books related to the topic in one way or another, to dreams or the inner life. So if you want to be a guest on a show like that as an author or dream worker yourself, you should contact her. Now, she's got a new site. It's at thedreamshow.tv. And you'll find a link, you'll find on the menus over on the right-hand side, there's a link that says something like, do you want to be a guest or be a guest on the show? So I thought you might like to know about that. And speaking of dreams, I just recently watched a Nova episode called Why Do We Dream? And it had some really interesting guests in that episode, or not guests, but, you know, people who are part of the show, scientists. And I jotted down lots of names for possible future interviews. And part of the thrust of it is that one of the understandings of why we dream is that the brain is rehearsing for future situations and also problem solving. Well, I had a problem. I have an iTunes account, and evidently somehow somebody got into my iTunes account and bought a bunch of video games that I didn't buy. And so this has been very much on my mind. And as a matter of fact, I was thinking about it as I went to bed last night. And then during the night, I had a dream. I don't remember the details of it, but I remember dreaming of something about credit cards. And then when I woke up in the morning, I had this realization that probably what had happened is that my son had sent me a $25 iTunes gift card for Father's Day. And I just woke up and I thought, that must have been a counterfeit card. And I went online, I Googled the idea of counterfeit iTunes gift cards, and sure enough, there was a story or two about that there. And the thing that made me think about that was I'd been given a $25 gift card, and all but 5 cents of the $25 had been spent on these video games. So it seemed like my brain was doing problem solving during the night. And when I woke up, here was this fresh idea, a seeming solution. Now, I've since consulted with a security expert, and I'm back to thinking that my iTunes account probably got hacked in, too, because we can't quite figure out how it could have been done with a counterfeit card and be applied to my account. So I'm exchanging emails with iTunes trying to get this resolved, but I just thought I would share this little exciting bit from my dream life with you. Unfortunately, I still have no new transcripts to announce. If you'd like to volunteer your services as a transcriber, do let me know. And as I mentioned last time, I'd really like to get some different sponsors going here. So if you have a business or a service you'd like me to verbally promote, please drop me a line and let's see if we can work something out. Or if you'd like to have a banner on our website, such as those that you can currently see in the right-hand sidebar on Shrink Wrap Radio, well, let's talk about that. Notice that I'm not talking about any commercial sponsors on this episode or the previous one. So please understand that it's your financial donations that I'm relying on. So a big thanks to all of you who have donated. And to the rest of you, please consider adding your name to the honor roll of Shrink Wrap Radio supporters.
Hi, this is Andy Hunt of Practical Wellbeing. We're all on the couch with Dr. Dave, so let's snuggle up and, hey, mind those elbows.
Thank you, Andy Hunt of Practical Wellbeing. I hope you're hearing this because I think my next guest will be right up your alley. More about that later. Well, let's dip into the email bag for some recent communiques from our listener community. In fact, the first one is a voicemail. Yay! It's from Alexandra.
Yes, hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Alexandra. I ended up sending a donation about a year and a half ago, which I'm probably due. I just want to say that's priceless and all the guests and the subjects that you're putting, which is fantastic. And by the way, I just wanted to know, which I believe is quite a complete person and really goes more in my era. Unfortunately, I believe at this point nobody has really interviewed him as much as you're able to actually do it. His name is Robert Ohoto. Oto, it's O-H-O-O-T-O. And all these O are like Oscar. Anyway, I'm looking forward to see if eventually you'll be looking into that. And bravo, again, for this wonderful show. And I don't know what's your near future in that show, but you certainly have a lot of wonderful illuminating material. And that's that on my part, and I'll send you a donation. Thank you.
Well, Alexandra, thanks for leaving that voicemail. It sounded like it might have been cutting out a little bit in there. But thanks for your suggestion of Robert Ohoto or something like that. I'll look him up and we'll see, although I do have quite a long list of guests lined up already. But I'll look into that, and I'm looking forward to receiving your donation. So thank you. And next we hear from Yoni, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Yoni Shiloh, and I'm a young doctor from Israel planning to specialize in psychiatry. I'm currently studying for my pre-internship exam, and on my spare time, I'm writing a psychology/philosophy blog. This week, I'm focusing on consciousness, and I would like to ask you the same question I've asked my friends and family during the last week. What does the word consciousness mean to you? I've been listening to your show for 2 years now, and I appreciate your views and attitude towards life, and that's the reason I'm asking you this question. I will also appreciate your permission to write about your answer in my blog, crediting you and your podcast, of course. Sincerely yours, Yoni Shiloh." Well, Yoni, thanks so much for that opportunity. It's great to hear from another listener in Israel, particularly a professional such as yourself. And here's what my answer was to Yoni, kind of just off the top of my head. I said, thanks so much for listening these past 2 years and for taking time to write and inviting me to comment on consciousness. Very succinctly, I see consciousness as the, quotes, master sense through which we apprehend everything of which we are aware. I think all living things may have various degrees of consciousness. It's our window on life, both inner and outer. I haven't really been asked this question before, and I may refine my answer as time goes on, but that's my off-the-top response. And then later that week, I did an interview with David Eagleman, who is the author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. That'll be coming up somewhere down the road. And I put that same question to him. So keep your ears tuned for that podcast and for his answer to that question. Here's one more. This one is from Kate. And this was posted as a comment to episode number 266, More in Hypnagogia, or Hypnagogia with Jerry Trumbull. And Kate writes, Hi, just listened to your latest podcast with Jerry, and I was struck by what he said about waking up paralyzed. My son spoke to me a little while ago about waking suddenly and being unable to move. He was very worried about it. I had heard of it, though never experienced it myself, and told him a bit about the brain that switches off your body in sleep. Sometimes your eyes and ears wake up before the rest of you. I've been sleep deprived for years due to having to get up at 5:30 to go to work and never seeming to be able to fit my life into getting to Betty By early enough. Ah, well, maybe when I retire I can get enough sleep and manage to try this fascinating technique. Keep up the good work. And I'll go and give you a review on iTunes. Okay, Kate, thanks very much for that comment. And I think that'll wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments like Kate did about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype like Alexandra did. Actually, she used our voicemail phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Pilar Jennings for sharing her insights on the power of relationship in psychoanalysis and Buddhism. On the next episode, which should come out next Friday, my guest will be Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener. He's a globe-trotting positive psychologist who's been called the Indiana Jones of positive psychology. And he's going to be a presenter at the International Positive Psychology Association conference that I'll be attending in Philadelphia. And that goes on July 23rd through July 26th. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.